KaiserNetwork.org.
Our two speakers are really terrific in this area, international experts. It's indeed a pleasure to introduce all four of our panelists at this moment. Let me start with our first two speakers. Dennis Prati is professor of health informatics at University of Victoria and visiting chair of health informatics at City University of London. He's a founding director of the University of Victoria School of Health Information Science and, in fact, fellow of the American College of Medical Informatics and in previous years commissioned by Her Majesty's Treasury to review the proposed National Health Service Information Strategy for England. And as well, we're joined by Ib Johansson, and he is Deputy Manager and Consultant at MedCom, Danish Center for Health Telematics, since 1994. And he has been very involved in implementing IT systems and in both hospitals and primary care environments over the past few years in Denmark. We have two speakers today also to respond to discussants. Katie Barr is from the Senate Health Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, which we were introduced to in the last session, and I had the privilege of working with Katie briefly at the AHIC, Secretary Leavitt's Commission on American Health Information Community, that seeks to support the goal of advancing electronic health records and health information technologies in the next decade. As well, we're joined by David Bowen from the Health Committee as well, Minority Staff Director on that committee. And so we will turn first to Dennis Prati for your overview. Dennis.
Thanks, Jonathan. Okay, we'll try to keep it short and brief to 15 minutes as we've been asked to. I'd like to first thank Robin of the Commonwealth Fund for inviting me to share the findings of a study I just completed not too long ago. And I'm very pleased that my good friend and colleague Ib Johansson's here to enlighten us all about what's going on in Denmark. I'll organize my comments around these sections. A few minutes on definitions, which I think are important. Give you the background to our study, which is a much humbler study than the impressive Commonwealth Fund study, which you heard about this morning. Give you our findings, some of our findings in only 15 minutes, some of the lessons that we drew from our work, and some concluding thoughts, and hopefully lots of time for discussion. In terms of definitions, we're a semantically challenged field, the field of health informatics. We unfortunately don't have an international agreement on terms, and I will phrase my comments this morning around electronic medical records, which in at least in North America, there's a general consensus that that term refers to the records about individuals inside a physician's office. The British used to use a term of electronic patient record to distinguish the records inside a facility, not a physician's office, but a facility, such as a hospital or a health center or a medical center. And there seems to be some consensus, although the literature is not consistent, that the term electronic health record is the longitudinal record that we are all striving to achieve someday, which will bring together the data in some fashion about all of our health events, regardless of where they occurred, in a variety of electronic medical records and a variety of electronic patient records, and bring it together. My comments today are almost exclusively around the electronic medical record, and more specifically in general practitioners and primary care, and not specialists and consultants. Backgrounds to our study. Well, the study was commissioned by an organization some of you may be aware of called Canada Health InfoWay. It's the organization in Canada which has been allotted $1.1 billion to advance the electronic health record agenda in Canada. And most of their funding has been directed towards acute care. And they were criticized that they were leaving out primary care and asked me to pull together some data about what's happening in other parts of the world, find out why primary care and the use of technology in primary care was so much higher. And you heard this morning from Robin that Canada and the United States are somewhat well, more than somewhat, are very, very far behind other countries around the world in terms of the use of technology by primary care physicians. So I picked 10 countries, and these were the 10 countries that were too hard to pick. We could have picked more, but a limited budget and limited time. But we picked these 10 because there was evidence in the literature that they all had a high degree of utilization of technology by their general practitioners and for clinical uses as opposed to for billing uses. Sorry. Now, how did we collect our data? Unlike the impressive work done by the Commonwealth Fund by Kathy and Robin and their colleagues, we used a survey technique. Most of our data was collected either from the literature, from previous studies that had been done, but most commonly by interviews. And we interviewed small numbers of people in each of these countries. I got a colleague from each of the 10 countries to work with me. That colleague was sometimes a fellow academic. In other cases, it was a member of the ministry, or in one case, it was a member of a private company. And we interviewed individuals inside that country, the so-called experts, the so-called knowledgeable people about what the status was. So our data ranges from being extremely robust. Some of the data is very reliable and very robust, down to surveys done 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. And at the bottom end, we're talking data that's estimates, best estimates, because there is no data available in that country that's been brought together. So it's based on small sampling. Okay, so we qualify a lot of our findings, realizing that the data quality varies tremendously. So what were some of our findings? Well, first of all, before we talk about the findings, I think it's important to recognize that most of these countries have been at this for a number of years. Okay? They've been at it for at least 10 years. And they've achieved a level of accomplishment that didn't occur overnight. It's only in Australia and Austria where the degree of utilization by GPs is more recent, and even that's 5 years ago. But when we look at countries that are leading the way in this area, they've been at it for 10 to 15 years. Well, I'm going to only give you some of our findings in the interest of time, but and we'll start with the application, which was the most common across all 10 countries that we studied. You remember that all these countries had at least 90% of their GPs having computers in their offices for clinical purposes. And the application which was most common in the 10 was the electronic prescribing of medications. Now, when we say that, we mean that the physicians entered the medication prescriptions into their computer and printed a script. We've decided to display our data in a fashion that rather than showing percentages, which we have specific percentages in some countries, but in other countries we can only estimate, that we'll display our data in a more simple fashion and say that most of the physicians, or most of the GPs, would be, if we say most, we're saying that at least 75% or higher of the GPs are using the technology in this fashion. And if it's many, it's more than 50%. So that takes us to realize that our first application, for the most common application, clinical application, is medication prescriptions in these 10 countries. Just to repeat the work that you saw this morning, I got this data yesterday, so I was able to build it in. The study showed, the Commonwealth study showed, the use of technology, again, is quite high in all the, is very high in a lot of the countries that Kathy and Robin studied, and of course low in Canada and the United States. Their study showed, and is consistent with our findings, that in terms of electronic prescribing of medications, you can see that, again, their findings are that it's quite high. And we could bicker about percentages and numbers, but I don't think that's the point. The point is that Canada and the United States are extremely, extremely low compared to these other countries. So these 10 countries of all solved the legibility problem. That doesn't mean they've solved all the problems, but they've solved at least the legibility problem. So They don't have this world anymore of handwritten prescriptions. They now have printed, legible prescriptions. So that when the pharmacist in most of the countries, in 8 of the 10 countries, that prescription is printed in the physician's office, the general practitioner's office, and given to the patient to physically carry to the pharmacy. In Denmark, and now increasingly in Sweden, and to a certain extent starting in England now, that prescription is transmitted electronically to the pharmacy. Next item we looked at, or the one I'm reporting about today, is the question of GPs recording progress notes, using their computers, in effect, to record their visits and their consultations with their patients. And we can see here that, again, 8 of the 10 countries, the utilization of the technology for that purpose is very high. It's less in Austria and Germany. When we say progress notes, the progress notes could either be entered by the physician themselves, or in some cases, the physician dictates their notes and a staff member enters the notes into the computer. But of course, once in the computer, the physician's able to see those notes the next time the patient comes and review them in electronic form. Looking at another dimension and outside the world outside the GP's office and their connection with the rest of the healthcare sector, we looked at transmission of medication prescriptions. And as I indicated just a few seconds ago, there's very little of that at the moment around in these 10 countries. The leaders in that domain are Denmark and Sweden, and England's catching up pretty fast. The most common communications application in the 10 countries, in other words, the use of receiving of data, clinical data, through electronic means, and we had to clarify in a couple of countries because we were informed by some of the people we interviewed that they thought a fax was electronic. So then when we asked them, did you get electronic lab results? So he said, oh yes, they're faxed in. Well, we didn't consider a fax. We wanted a computer-to-computer type of interchange. So in these countries, you can see it's, again, quite high. In terms of, for most of them, most of the GPs in Denmark, New Zealand, and Scotland receive their data, their laboratory results electronically, and it's only lower in Germany and Norway. Again, confirmation and support of the findings from the Commonwealth study that when Kathy and Robin collected their data that showed, again, the very high degree to which the countries that they looked at had laboratory results coming in electronically. Looking at another important aspect, which I'm sure the primary care physicians in the room would support, is that one of the critical pieces of data which primary care physicians would like is the discharge summaries of their patients who are in the hospital. And in Canada, the United States, and in most parts of the world, that's a document that tends to come many, many days, in fact, not weeks, after the patient has left. And the only country that's making any significant progress in that regard at the moment is Denmark, but New Zealand and Scotland are not too far behind in terms of receiving. That has all sorts of policy implications, particularly at an institutional, organizational level, because it's not a technology issue, it's an issue of process and procedures, having discharge summaries dictated soon after the patient is discharged. We asked the physicians that we interviewed what their benefits were to them, and we heard some comments yesterday that perhaps their greatest benefits are not to the physicians, and there's an element of truth to that. A lot of the benefits of technology are often to the providers and to patients, but not or to the purchasers and to the patients as opposed to the providers. But their data suggests that there is indeed some benefits. And the most common benefit that we were able to determine from our study was repeat prescriptions. Not the original prescription, that's more time consuming. It takes our GPs longer to do that on a computer than it does on a piece of paper. But where they do save time and have some benefits is on the repeat prescriptions. And we had a simple scale of 1 to 8, 1 being the most important. And it showed that it was the number one benefit in Scotland, Sweden, and number two in almost all the other countries except for Norway and New Zealand, but they weren't very far down the list. So that was the most common benefit. Saving time was the next benefit identified, and it was the number one benefit in 5 countries. Okay. There's some more benefits. We'll skip through. It's amazing how fast 15 minutes go. Okay, lessons to be learned. Robin's the one who pushed me on this. I had not done it to date, and I was reluctant to do it, but she quietly persuaded me to do it. So I call it a very crude ranking. Okay, it's crude because the data, raw data, is not as robust as I'd like it to be. And it only looks at 5 variables, the one I have today. And it's based on a simple, very simple scale and a very simple methodology. And I run the risk of doing this of the wrath of my academic colleagues for the simplicity of the methodology and perhaps some of the discomfort of some of the countries who don't rank quite as high as others. That being said, we'll have a go at it. So most means a score of 4. That means that over 75% of the GPs are achieving that. 3 for many, and so on. So based on that, this was how the data comes out. Okay, and it shows that Denmark is at the lead, and many of you probably realize that Denmark is indeed leading the world in terms of the application of information technology, particularly in primary care. It's not as easy to comment about secondary care and acute care as to whether they're leading, but they're definitely leading in terms of primary care. And we see another group, Scotland, New Zealand, Sweden, not far behind. England also there. And, of course, if we looked at more variables, it's possible that these numbers would change. I think for those of us in Canada, United States, what's significant is that these countries are producing these kind of numbers. If we were to score Canada, United States, we'd probably be down in 4 and 5 range, if that high. So I think that's the main message for our countries. This data is unweighted, and in a sense, unweighted. If we were to mathematically adjust the data build based on our confidence factor of the raw data, then what would happen is the gap between Denmark and the rest of the countries would widen, because Denmark does tend to have some of the best data about what's happening in their country. And that's, if we adjusted that, the gap would be wider. The study by the Commonwealth Fund, they looked at 7 factors. I just reported on 5. They looked at 7 factors in terms of 7 out of 14 functions, and in effect ranked the countries this way. And if we compare the findings of our 2 studies, the Robin and Kathy's data shows New Zealand at the top, UK, Australia, Netherlands, and Germany. And if we look at the data of the study I did on 5 functions, New Zealand's first. Of course, we're dropping Denmark and the other countries. We're only looking at these 5 countries. New Zealand would come first. England would come second. Netherlands third. Australia fourth. And Germany fifth. So there's some consistency in the findings of our 2 studies as to what countries are dealing. And David, well, we could get England up a little higher, David, but we'll leave it the way it is for now. Okay, driving forces. I was asked, this was the heart of what I was asked to do from my Canada Health InfoWay for our Canadian health policy people. And this particular finding disturbed some of them. It wasn't what they were looking for. They were hoping it would be all no. But you can see that the government funding support was not a consistent factor in all the countries. Some of these countries have progressed rather well without a lot of government support. Electronic billing mandate was another factor. College or association leadership, another factor we looked at. Peer influence, another important factor. And you can see when all the yeses that they were factors in why these countries have achieved what they've achieved. Accreditation of vendor systems is another indicator. In most of the countries, that played a significant role. Non-financial support that physicians receive is another important factor. And I'll finish with some conclusions. Running out of time. There are some similarities, and government policy is one of them. And this policy is not necessarily an information technology-related policy. It's more a policy about health reform. It's more around physician collectives. Some of the countries that are leading the way are because their governments felt the importance of physicians working in groups as opposed to working independently. Same for out-of-office hours policies and so on. Legislation is another aspect. A lot of these countries have dealt with their privacy legislation and have dealt with issues such as electronic signatures. We cannot by law electronically transmit prescriptions in Canada. The law does not allow us to do that, so we're going to have to change our legislation in order to do that. As well, other policy in terms of health information technology. One of the surprise findings wasn't something we expected and wasn't something we looked for, but it came out, is that one of the factors which seems to influence progress is that there is some form of single unifying organization in the country. And it doesn't take the same form. In Denmark, it's a nonprofit organization called Medcom, which Ib will talk about. In New Zealand, it's a private company called HealthLink. And in Scotland, it's the Department of Health. But there is a single focus point that acts as a catalyst. Other factors are the realities of culture and tradition, both from a point of view of countries as well as professions. A realization that this is not something that's done overnight. It takes time, and more importantly, it has to be managed, as well as other factors. The last one is something we're going to be exploring in more depth, and it's the notion or the observation that perhaps size could be a contributing factor, and that small is beautiful, and that it's perhaps part that smaller nations indeed can progress. But what was, in closing, what was clear in all the countries was that if they wanted to move to the electronic health record, and now I'm back to the electronic health record, that record that brings together data from multiple sites and multiple organizations, that it's impossible without the general practitioners involved. And I thought it was put nicely by the Australian Minister of Health about a year ago, speaking in their house about the importance that physicians are the heart of the system, and we can't have an integrated record when most of their notes are on cardboard carts. So I'll finish there and turn it over to Ib. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. And we now hear from Ib Johansson, representing Denmark, a high performer on the Prodi scale.
Yes, thank you for having the possibility to come here and tell a little about how the penetration of using EMR at the GPs in Denmark is, and how we have come to this point. So it was a great pleasure for me when I got a mail from Robin that I could, if I would like to come to here to Washington to make such a presentation. And I have lots of slides. I have skipped some of them. Otherwise, it would last at least 2 hours. So if you follow on the handouts, there will be some of them which I have skipped over. But my name is Ib, and that's right. They run out of letters when I was born. I'm coming from Denmark, and you know Denmark. We have the Copenhagen, and the office where I'm working in this organization, it's a public organization called Medcom. But it's working on private conditions, and we are a non-profit organization. It's placed in Odense, the city of Hans Christian Andersen, and I'm living there in the southern part of this small island called Funen, and this is also called the Garden of Denmark. So this is some touristic information. If you go to Denmark, you should go there. Nevertheless, they also say that the girls in Funen, they say the night is our own, so you have something to see there. And nevertheless, we have to go to the reality. I should point out what we have running, why does it work, and some of the benefits for the different partners in the health sector, amongst them the citizens, and about the future, what is just around the corner, and what are we making politics around. Just a few words about the Danish health sector. We are 5.3 million inhabitants. We have quite many public hospitals, ranging from 25 beds up to 1,500. They are all public. All treatment in hospitals are free. We have a waiting time guarantee for 2 months. From next year, it will be 1 month. And if you will not have the treatment in the public hospital within this limit, you can choose among all the different private hospitals, both in Denmark and abroad, and the counties, they are going to pay for it. We have the private health sector, where we have the GPs, they are the gatekeepers. They, all treatment at the GPs is free of charge, as well as in the hospitals. But to go to a hospital, you need to have a written referral from the GPs to have the treatment in the hospital. We have private specialists, and they act as GPs, so they are completely private, and you have to have a referral to go there from your GP, and it's also free of charge. So you shouldn't pay anything. All these things is reimbursed from the local government, from the regions. We have only 331 pharmacies. They are all licensed. And then we have some other partners in the primary health sector. And they are all computerized. That means they have electronic records. And the scope of it is that they can communicate with each other, all these different partners. We have the municipalities. We have lots of them. But at the end of this year, we will have a reform where the 15 counties will be 5 regions and the 271 municipalities will only be 98. And they are responsible for all the home care. We have one private health insurance because some of the drugs, some of the medicine, some treatment like the dentist, the physiotherapist, the chiropractors and psychologists is going to be paid by the patients so they can have an extra private health insurance. Otherwise, everything is paid by over the taxes, and it is paid by the local government. I skip this one. Just the organization Medcom, which is running this health data network, it is funded by the Minister of Health and this Association of County Councils. They are paying for it, and we have a small budget, only 2 million euros a year, and 40% is used for staff and 60% for running projects. What is Medcom then? We make project ideas within electronic communications. We manage the project, so we have many of the scopes is have this communication disseminated so it is in wide use. We make consensus about and we make standards about how should this be used in the health sector, and we give some technical advice to the software suppliers. We market all the solutions that it is the best and the only way to do it is doing it electronically and not on paper. And then we have the office where we approve and make acknowledgement of all software solutions in the health sector that they are going to use this Medcom solutions and Medcom standards. And it's completely openness. Everything is free of charge. It's open, so you can see what the colleagues and what the other vendors are doing. It is open in the net. One thing which has been very important in all this is that we have a unique national identifier. Maybe you know that, but this one is mine, and it's used for everything, not only health, also for taxation, driving license, and all this. So this is the key in all this electronic communication, in all the health records. It is this national citizen identifier. It's called CPR. What happens when you go to a GP? All GPs, they have this electronic medical records, and if they want to issue an electronic prescription, they use the electronic medication record with the data from the Danish drug agency, and where they can see and find out the right medication for the patient. They sent the prescription electronically to whatever pharmacy by the patient's choice, and he will have an acknowledgement back that it has been received at the pharmacy. At the same time, he can send referrals to whatever hospital he wants in the country, and he will receive this discharge letters back when the patient is discharged. He will have outpatient summaries. He will have X-ray reports, everything in the same way. He can make electronic laboratory requests, and of course, he can receive all lab results back and in the same way. To refer to private specialists, the summary from the private specialist, it is done in the same way. Reimbursement claims to the local health insurance once a month, it is sent. And we have out-of-office hours where we have a service which is manned by GPs. They will always send information about each patient they have seen during evening and nighttime to the family doctor. The same with the physiotherapist, they send these summaries about the treatment. For all the patients which are receiving a home care service, when they are admitted to a hospital, they will have an automatic message that now is a patient in the hospital, and when the patient is discharged, they will have a message that now is a patient discharged, so they have to start the service again. All these things, we can double over this, all these things is handled in this network we call the Medcom network or the health data network. And what is it now? We have 87% of all prescriptions. They are transmitted electronically. And 98% of all prescriptions are made electronically. The rest, the difference between them is printed out. Almost all the discharge letters, the outpatient notes are electronically, and all the lab results, and most of the referrals and the reimbursements. The lab requests are still lacking being electronically. We have 98% of all the DPs, they can communicate electronically with using this Medcom standards. The private specialists, it is 84% today, and all the hospitals, all the pharmacies, this call service and the health insurance, all of them can communicate electronically. That means we have more than one document electronically each second in the country. They are all based on different standards which is developed by Medcom, and today it is obligatory in all tenders that you should handle these standards and you should implement them in the software solution. And all software suppliers, they are behind. They say, oh, it's a good idea. We have just one way of doing this. And all the counties, all the hospital owners, they are behind. They will implement this, and they have implemented it. So they say, if we have a discharge letter, it is always sent electronically. And most important, the doctors' association is behind. And that means that they are encouraging their colleagues to use EMRs and to use this electronic communication. We rank the different counties. The best one on top, and the worst one on the bottom. For some, we can see here they have which rank of the prescriptions. Oh, sorry. And we have here the rank of the different GPs who have electronic communication. All the software suppliers, they're also ranked and put on the website, so we can always see who is the good and who is the bad ones. So you should never buy a red flag. So if it is a car from Italy, a Fiat or something like that, we would point it out as a red one, maybe. So you shouldn't buy such one. And it has been very important for the software suppliers that they are in this scheme. What have we learned? We have learned that it is very important that there is a national commitment and a regional commitment to have this electronic communication and to have this EMRs at the DP's clinics. And the policy from the government must support this ideas, And we have an agreement about that the DP should use this electronic communication and they should use EMRs. There have been some economic incentives. They have saved quite much money using EMRs and electronic communication, but they can have the money in their own pocket offering better service. What we have also seen that there have been a collegial pressure. Why are you going to use EMRs? And when the colleagues meet in what we call 12-man women's clubs, that's the local clubs with DPs, where they talk together about medical matters. And they, of course, they say, "Oh, you are out of the gang because you don't have a computer." So this has been some of the pressure to reach the level. Also, the local pharmacies, they normally meet with the DPs that they and encourage them to use IT. So the information and promotion is important. And then, again, Medcom, it's a neutral healthcare to the healthcare providers and all the software companies. So they can just get some advice from Medcom, but we are neutral to them. I have one slide here which shows some of the outcomes of having this EMRs. We have seen during the last 5 years there have been a raise in the number of consultations in the DP at the DPs. At the same time, we have seen a slightly decrease in the number of DPs. It is not that nice to be a DP in Denmark anymore. So we have this slightly reduction, but at the same time, they are investing in IT, and this IT it is supporting that they can have more consultation. That's the main scope and the main focus they have had. Invest in IT, and then you can treat more patients within the same time. Another one is that the Minister of Health. We have the decision that all patients. They should be able to get into contact with the DP by telephone in the morning between 8 and 9. But it's completely impossible to fulfill this. So the health minister decided that they should offer email consultation too. And to do this, the telephone call, they will only be refunded 25 Danish crowns. But if they are using email consultation for the same things, they will have the double payment. So they have really raised the number of email consultations. And this is some of the carrots you can say. How are they going to use new technology? Another thing is what we have seen because of this widespread IT use is that the number of cases where we have seen cervical cancer in one of the counties, it went down from 62 in 1988 to 18 in 2004. And the reason is that they are using IT system, the EMRs, just to remind the patients, now it's time for this smear tests, and if they are not showing up, they will have a new reminder, and the lab results is sent back to the GP electronically, and he is responding their results to the patient by an email if they want it. So there we have got a very high penetration of this cytology screening. I think it is more than 95% of all the patients, of all the persons within 23 and 59 years, that they are participating in this scheme. And the number of deaths has decreased from 29 in 1988 to 12 in 2001. So there are some benefits of using IT. We just dropped this one. The new thing we have made is a health portal. And this health portal, it's accessible from both the professionals and the citizens. And to get there, you need to have a digital certificate. All the citizens can have a digital certificate free of charge. And when you have this, you can see your own lab results just using your patient identifier from all biochemistry labs in Denmark. And the physicians in the DPs, they have access to this. So if they are having a patient which is normally not come to his clinic, he can have access to all these lab results. It is possible. They can also see what medication is the patient receiving on this health portal. All medication from each citizen, this is mine, it is put onto a central database, and all doctors have access to see this medication. But very important, this one, this is my name, and it is locked who have been looking into this file. So all this data which have been looked up, you will have a lock file where you as a citizen, as a patient, can see who have been looking on my data. And this for medication, and this one is how it looks like when it is in a hospital or when it is in a GP's clinic, he can look what medication, which type of medication this patient has actually got. We can see all the hospital cases. This is mine. I have been, this is my ID, and here you can see from 1997 to 2005, I have been in a hospital four times, and I can see for what. It's also open for physicians. All the waiting times from all the treatments, it's open on the net. The citizens and the DPs can have access to this, and they can see the quality, the number of cases each ward is have had for the last 12 months. So you can choose among the best ones or the quickest ones. It's up to the patient to decide this together with the DP when they send this electronic referral. We have also, for half of all citizens, we put the data from the hospital systems. That means the hospital information systems, the discharge letters, the episode of care, it's put onto a central database. When you're admitted to a hospital, the doctor there, he have access to this one and can see what have been done to this specific patient for the last, no, back to 1974. But it's only for half of the citizens. We drop all this one. For the, just to see one of the things which have been also for the future where we plan to give more more possibilities for self-treatment. It is for the chronic diseases. This is one for also on the health portal. Yes, I'm fine. I finalize. This is my last slide. The patient can chip in this, the laboratory value for anticoagulant therapy and their date, and then there will be the proposed dosage here from Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and so on. So he can see it on the health portal. What shall I do and which medication am I going to take? So we plan to do much of these things using IT, and the DP he have access to this tool, and he is receiving a copy of it. We have made a national scheme for laboratory requests. We have just one form for all laboratories in the country. So when a GP is making an electronic request, he's only going to have printed out one form in his office, which is covering all laboratories in the country. It have reduced the tube labeling failures from 18% when they were using paper-based requisitions down to 2% now. So what is the status? We still have this transfer of messages, but the patient's access to their own data and the self-treatment, it is really the high topic. And the actual healthcare provider, he have access to see this data, and this patient, this informed patients, they can do more when they have access and to this data. It's obligatory to use EMRs by the DPs now. It's obligatory to offer email consultations within the end of next year, and then we have this digital certificate. It was a little bit quick. Denmark is a small country, but we have Greenland, so if you ever go for dog sledging, you can go there. It's a nice country. Thank you.
Thank you, Ip, for a terrific presentation. I think you set the bar high, not only in terms of the implementation, but the linkage to quality and outcomes. Indeed, it'd be interesting now to hear the response from two representatives of the United States, again, the staff committee that helps to prepare the legislative approach to addressing these sorts of issues. And I have it on good authority they're already considering a field hearing to the beautiful parts of Denmark. Let me introduce Katie Bohr.
Thank you so much. I would just like to say a formal housekeeping remark that my comments are off the record and not for attribution. When Chairman Enzi took chairmanship of the HELP Committee about 2 years ago, he saw health information technology as a top item on his healthcare agenda. As we began working on the legislation that is very bipartisan, and we worked closely with Senator Kennedy's office as well as other offices on both sides of the aisle, we attempted to address three goals that we'd heard repetitively from folks in the industry, three barriers to adoption of health information technology. The first one was a lack of standards. There are no common standards in the U.S. right now, so Hospital A in Washington, D.C. can speak with Hospital B in Lusk, Wyoming. So we saw addressing standards for interoperability as a key priority of the bill. The second main goal that we tried to achieve, or the barrier that we tried to address, was a lack of physician adoption of health information technology. The cultural barriers that exist, as well as the interruption in workflows as a part of health IT. The third piece is a lack of funding. Folks not only had trouble deciding which computer system to purchase based on standards, but they lacked the funding to purchase that system. So the bill that we wrote and that passed the Senate about a year ago, we started working on it 2 years ago, does a number of things. We codify the Office of the National Coordinator, formerly Dr. David Braylor's office, and now Rob Kolodner from the Veterans Affairs. We also codify the American Health Information Community as an attempt to address the standards for interoperability and formalize private sector input in that process. We also have a number of grant programs in the bill to try to get the funding out to the people that need it. One very, very interesting concept that we looked at was a revolving loan fund for states, grants to states for states to then create the loan funds to fund the systems. Another piece that we have in the bill is a clinical demonstration to educate physicians in the classroom about the benefits of health information technology. We also have a section on quality measurement. If we at some point begin to pay for performance, how do we first measure quality, and how do we know if a physician is indeed improving quality to improve outcomes? The House, our colleagues in the House passed a bill early this summer, and we've been working diligently with them to try to compromise on various pieces. As of this date, we do not have a compromise, but we are still working with them to try to conference a bill, and we are hopeful that we will pass something in the lame duck session. With that, I will end and let David speak. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie. And now David Bowen is the Minority Staff Director for the Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, or HELP Committee.
Okay. I'll start with the same disclaimer that Katie started with. The comments I'm making are on background. I have to say that it's always slightly embarrassing to be present at meetings with international comparisons of healthcare systems, particularly on health IT. I always feel like everyone else has discovered the secret of fire, and we're still banging the rocks together, hoping for a spark. We are very, very far behind. When you see these results from Denmark, from New Zealand, from Britain, from elsewhere, it makes you realize both the potential of health IT and also the distance we have to travel. As Katie described, the legislation that is currently pending before the Congress is at least one very small step, an important step, but a small step nonetheless forward. And hopefully we can take that step and continue on to others. The one ray of hope, or at least mitigation of frustration, is that people have been complaining about healthcare quality for quite some time. This is a quote from Florence Nightingale 150 years ago. So this has been an ongoing issue, and there have been a series of efforts to try and address this. And I think that it's enormously positive that health IT does have such a potential to improve quality. I have a number of slides which I will whip through and probably ignore most of, because I'm really speaking to the choir here, and many of you are familiar with the data. So, but just even within our home state of Massachusetts, the use of electronic health records is very low. And Massachusetts, I would add, is a leading state in the use of health IT, and elsewhere the use is much lower. Investment here is far lower than in other countries. This is just one that I think resonates both from the perspective of people interested in healthcare quality and from the perspective of patients. An extraordinary number of encounters with the healthcare system here result in missing or involve missing information. This has obvious consequences for quality of care, but also for the hassle factor of patients who have to wait around or face an incomplete diagnosis because critical information is missing. There are a series of barriers, and I apologize for the rather lurid color scheme of this. It seems to have not gone over terribly well in the PowerPoint. There are a series of problems that have been identified as barriers to health IT adoption, startup costs, standards, lack of time and cost, privacy concerns, training. And I think that our legislation at least begins to address many of these, and I think that that's one of the reasons why it's an important step to take. It certainly starts the process of addressing the standards. It will provide, if funded, at least some help with the startup costs, and it has various measures to improve training. So hopefully that there will be some progress made. I just want to identify, and there's been a lot of talk about the use of health IT to improve quality. I want to talk just for a moment about the use of health IT to save money. This is just one example, and in the slide here, the source came off. This is from a hospital system which was using paper records and then switched to electronic health records, and looking at the use of generic drugs, appropriate use of generic drugs, clearly spiked extremely shortly after the switch. And this is, of course, an electronic health record coupled with decision support. On this slide, which is from the Latter-day Saints Hospital in Salt Lake City, if you look at the use of health IT, use of electronic health records, and its impact on quality of care and cost of care, this is with an infectious disease ICU. You look at each measure and you see that patients are getting fewer drugs, better drugs, they're surviving better, they're spending less time in the ICU. The interesting part of this slide, too, there's a fuller version which has a third bar in each frame, and the third bar shows, the second bar, the sort of pinkish bar, shows what happens when the recommendation of the decision support was followed, and you see these positive outcomes. The third bar, which isn't on this slide, shows the example when the doctor said, well, you know, they're just wrong. In all cases when the decision support was ignored, the bars are about the same as they were before Health IT was installed. The results are much worse. Again, there are some sort of macro projections about what the healthcare system could save. This is somewhat extrapolative about the projected savings, but if you look at the projections on the red bar or the red line at the top, as the projected health savings. The yellow bar shows what the results would be if we simply had a 1.5% annual productivity improvement, which is typical, I'm told, for the retail industry. The savings are $350 billion. If you had a 4% annual productivity improvement, which is just half of the rate of improvement of the telecom industry, you'd have this over $800 billion improvement. So the potential for both improved quality and improved efficiency is really enormous. And when you see slides such as those shown in the first presentation today, showing how out of whack the U.S. system is with regard to spending and quality, you see that we really need to make progress in areas that don't impact patient care, and I think use of health IT is one of those. I think my last slide, it just people, especially from overseas, sometimes wonder about the role of congressional staff. This last slide, I think, graphically illustrates what we do. People have said that the process of making legislation, like the process of making sausage, should not be seen at close quarters. We're sort of our role in as health staff or as legislative staff is to sort of help the sausage along. And there's Katie feeding it into the top, and there's me holding it as it comes out. And I think there are two lessons to be learned here. One, even though the process may be a little jarring to look at, sometimes the product is actually quite tasty. And we hope that with regard to our health IT legislation, even though the process of getting there has been somewhat sausage-like, the final product will be one that we all like. Thank you very much.
Well, terrific presentations and comments. And indeed, the bar is raised high. We have time for a couple of questions. Let me Julian. Is there a microphone? No. Great.
In France, the electronic health records were essentially killed by the physicians because they were afraid of the competition, that once the power of information was actually given to the patient about health records, that meant the patient could go anywhere, didn't necessarily go to the doctor. We're having problems in the UK. I mean, there may be a number of reasons about physician engagement. I mean, there may be a number of possible reasons. There's fears about privacy, and there's possible fears about an audit trail. And again, one suspects that the competition fear might be emerging itself there. I mean, I wonder how Denmark actually managed to overcome that problem. Was it a problem in Denmark about physician engagement? And how did they deal with it? And more generally, I mean, I'd be interested in the panel's views about how one gets physician engagement in the light of these very real oppositional pressures.
Would you start?
I'll try. Yes. It's on. Okay, I'll try to answer it. Yes, if you remember one of my slides, there was lots of them, but this MITCOM organization, which is setting the standards and which was paid by the Minister of Health and the County Association, one of the most important partners in that steering committee is the Danish Doctors Association. And they are not paying for being there, but they have a great influence. So they are a partner in setting the standards and setting how should the different IT solutions be developed and how should they work. That's very important. The other thing is that there was a pressure against the hospitals, the pharmacies, that they should be supportive, that they should offer this service to send lab results, to send discharge letters, so they could receive them electronically. So there was an agreement about that. And as soon as these things was running, they were investing in it. And I didn't mention, but it's very important that the GPs in Denmark, they are not supported by the government financially to buy computers. They have done it by their own pockets. So I would say, because of this openness, you can see on the net who is performing well. It has been one of the things for the success.
Before we go to Dennis, let me ask you to comment. Why did they choose to do it for themselves? This is a big question in the United States, and clearly in implementation, it actually takes a little longer during the startup phase to actually do your work. You use your time differently, but why did they want to do it? What motivated them?
I think one of the things which motivates doctors is that you can reduce your expenses or you can raise your income. And of course, when you have more patients, we have seen in this telephone time in the consultation between 8 and 9 in the morning, normally they could reply 15 calls. But using these EMRs, we have seen that they can handle more than 60 in 1 hour. So they can have more income, they have more relevant data. Everything is ready when the patient calls, so they don't have to look up on paper-based records. That's some of the things, at least. A higher quality. They can easily find the patient record. That's quite important. They are so tremendous, so big, all these paper-based records. So just to find the right records, it takes time. So this has been some of the scopes, yes?
Dennis, did you want to comment on that?
I'll just add a couple of comments to what Ib said. I think it's important to realize the origins of the Denmark success story. It's a physician-based system. It started in the early 90s with two physicians getting together, a GP and a pathologist, and the GP saying to the pathologist, this is crazy. I'm sending you a lab request. You send me back the results on a piece of paper printed by your computer. It arrives in my office in the mail, and I then retype the results into my computer. Surely we should be able to do something. So they started with applications that benefit the GPs and the physicians. And it grew from that. The little Funen County where this all started is now still the county that runs the national system. That's one point. Julian, the second point is the question around privacy, concerns, and notions, okay? The Danish approach started and was solely, until the portal was created, was solely a point-to-point messaging system where a physician, GP, sent a message to another specific, to a specific specialist as they would in a traditional fashion, not to a center or a clinic, but to a specific point-to-point message. And that, they went on that way until and grew and grew and grew with more and more messages. And it's now only in the last year or two, with the creation of the portal and the creation of the so-called shared record, where now it says that people other than who are outside the control of an individual may have access to this data, that they do have some concerns, okay? They do have some concerns, okay? And there's been a couple of projects that have been held back about who gets to see what. And the other third point is that unlike a number of countries in the world that are moving to a single record type of philosophy, an EHR, which is one record which everybody shares, the Danes at the moment have chosen not to go that route. The Danes have chosen that they will have laboratory results, and physicians can look into the laboratory results regardless of where the patient has been. They can look into the medication data. Okay? They can look into the imaging data, but they're not intending at the moment to bring that data together in one record.
We have time for two short questions. Let's go first to Gail Walensky.
I want to pursue the privacy issue. As you're probably aware, that this is a major hurdle in the U.S. We obviously have easily available the single identifier, the Social Security number, but there is tremendous concern about making use of it and the kinds of problems that would come if we had a unified record that would be available through a portal system. Aside from some of the peculiar concerns that may be just to the U.S., do you think that this is something that you see in other countries being able to be resolved, that is having a single electronic health record that will be available through a portal system? Do you think the privacy issues, the ability to break through technically the kinds of concerns for either identity theft or hackers who want to do this to show that they can, are real concerns, and from your looking at other countries, or if Ib would like to respond in terms of Denmark's contemplation, how serious an issue do you think this is?
Well, We didn't look explicitly when we did our study at the privacy issue, okay? But it clearly came up a number of times. I mean, we can see that concern being expressed in a number of different jurisdictions around the world. I mean, it's considered to be one of the major barriers to our progress in Canada. It's a complex issue, and I think, again, it behooves us to take a closer look at the Danes and their approach and what they seem to be able to accomplish. I mean, I think it's very, very significant, as Ip pointed out, that a citizen can go and see who exactly has been looking at my data, and it's displayed right in front of them, okay? My sense is that our provider communities around the world are more concerned about the privacy issue than our citizens are. It doesn't mean to say that our citizens aren't, but my sense is, and I don't spend a lot of time studying this, but what I have seen is that the public is more willing to so-called share their data with a variety of clinicians than even clinicians are to share their data with other clinicians, okay? And I know, David, you might want to add some comments about that, but I mean, and I'm seeing that when I look at privacy, and as I said, I don't spend a lot of time in it. I see it in a number of ways, okay? And it's part of what I think we've been raised a number of times in the last 2 days, is reforming the way in which we carry out our activities. The way we've been doing it for 30, 40, 50 years, we're having to change that. And that change is difficult. It's difficult for some of our jurisdictions and some of our providers to open up, okay? Because historically, we haven't had a healthcare system that's perceived to be open, okay? And yet, most countries seem to be moving in that direction. I mean, Sweden, I just came back from Sweden, and I was able to confirm that 10 of their 21 counties are moving to an approach of a single record. They already have it in the county of Norrbotten, which is a very small county, the biggest geographical county of Sweden, but the smallest, one of the smaller ones by population, where they have a single record, so that all the providers in that county have access to the same record. So it's not, they don't have the EMR and the EPR. They have, in effect, an EHR. Now, when you look more deeply into it, that is not physically one record. It's bringing together data about that one person from 80 or 90 different systems. So there's a cardiology system, there's a neurology system, there's a diabetes system, there's an orthopedic system, and those specialists have their data, the richness of their data that they need to carry out their roles, but there's also the shared data so that the GP can see the relevant orthopedic data, can see the relevant gynecological data. And it's Southern Spain and Andalusia appears to be moving in the same direction as well. They already have a unique single record for 8 million people for all of primary care. So all the primary health centers in the entire province of Andalusia use one record. Like the VA uses one record, they have one record. And their intent, I'm told, and I'm going to Spain next week to find out, their intent is to move that capability into and through all of their hospitals, so that it appears like Sweden, at least many parts of Sweden, that they're moving to that approach.
Okay, let's stop there. It's been a very provocative discussion. There have been, I see, a number of hands, and I know that some of the hands are on speakers on the next panel. And so with respect to that next panel and those views, let me thank all of the panelists for the terrific and obviously very provocative comments. I'll leave you with one provocative comment. It's not causal, it's observational, and it's published in the journal started by a Harkness Fellow, Adam Oliver, but in VA, just along with the improvements in quality, we associate a 6% increase in operational efficiency annually. So I think there is a there, and look forward
as is one of the great outputs of the Commonwealth Fund and the Alliance for Health Reform's approach, ongoing dialogue on these critically important topics. Again, many thanks to the panelists. Thank
you. Closing discussion. For those of you who are not Americans, we have a tradition, a July 4th tradition here, and we always finish the fireworks with what we call the grand finale. So that's what we're anticipating now, a very, very interesting, stimulating, provocative discussion. And we're really, really privileged to have Mark McClellan here with us today to chair this. He is the visiting senior fellow at AEI Brookings Joint Center for Regulatory Affairs, but probably more familiar, as I said this morning, to those in this audience in his most recent role as administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And I'm delighted to turn this panel over to Dr. Mark McClellan. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you, and I'm going to talk loud so that everybody who is in line to get their sandwiches and salads can hear me over the background noise. We really appreciate you all letting us go ahead and get moving with this discussion. We've had a lot of interesting discussions already this morning. Our panelists and discussants have a lot to say as well. So thank you all very much for being here. One of the great things you get to do as a former administrator is moderate interesting panels. And this is a very interesting one that we have today on, are there opportunities for the United States to learn from looking abroad? As those of you who have been here for this morning's conference sponsored by the Commonwealth Fund and the Alliance for Health Reform know, there obviously are many opportunities for all of us to learn from each other in implementing health policies effectively. We're all facing the same kinds of challenges. We're dealing with them in different ways, and that creates opportunities for learning. That's why meetings like this and discussions around different health policies are so important. I'm very pleased to be joined here today by two truly distinguished leaders from Commonwealth countries. First, we're going to hear from Paul Corrigan, who's the head advisor for Tony Blair in the Labor Party, working at number 10 Downing Street. Paul has a very interesting background that combines academic work and having a big impact on policy. He's an academic who has been specializing in inner-city social policy and welfare practice, teaching at Warwick University and the Polytechnic of North London. He's also been involved in a hands-on way in local government in London as well, and a management consultant working for both himself and the Office of Public Management on changes and improvements in public services. He's been working in the Labor Party as education policy advisor and from 2001 to 2005 as a special advisor to the Secretaries of State for health, so very much in the midst of all of the health policy debates and discussions ongoing in the United Kingdom. We're also joined by Alan Fels, the Dean of the Australia and New Zealand School of Government. It's a new institution established jointly by the governments of Australia, New Zealand, Victoria, New South Wales, Queensland, and Western Australia, as well as 12 universities and business schools who are getting together to solve a very important problem, providing effective education and management development programs for high-level public sector managers. And Alan Fels is an excellent person to serve in this job, given his background in academics and in policymaking. Previously, Fels was the chairman of the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission from 1995 to 2003. Before that, he was the chairman of the Trade Practices Commission and chairman of the Prices Surveillance Authority. And he is also has been appointed by the Australian government as a consumer and privacy advisor to head the new Access Card Consumer and Privacy Task Force. In addition to all that, he's a fellow of the Australian Academy of Social Science and has been awarded the Order of Australia. So two very distinguished speakers to hear from about issues that both the United Kingdom and Australia are facing that have some direct relevance for us. I'm going to let you hear from them about those issues. I'd also like to go ahead now and introduce our distinguished discussants.
to people I've spent a lot of time with over the years. Mark Hayes, Esquire, is the chief health policy advisor for the Senate Finance Committee, working for Chairman Chuck Grassley. He's been the principal staff person, really the lead architect, working on a broad range of policy issues, including all of the major Medicare policy issues facing our country. Before joining the committee staff, he has worked for Senator Olympia Snowe, for Senator Jim Jeffords, Senator Kit Bond. He's been had a lot of experience here on the Hill, and in addition to all that, he also has a background in pharmacy, so a truly distinguished background. And also, on our distinguished panel, we're very pleased to have Sibel Bjorklund, who's the Democratic staff director for the House Ways and Means Health Subcommittee, a post she's held for a number of years and served with great distinction in. Previously, she served as Senator Ted Kennedy's deputy staff director for health policy on the Health Committee and spent time as a legislative aide for former Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle. Previously, she'd been a Medicare insurance policy analyst at then HCFA, now my former agency, CMS, so she knows Medicare policy issues and healthcare issues inside and out from all of this experience. So very pleased to have all of you here today, very pleased to have our distinguished panel here today, and Mr. Corrigan, if I can call on you to begin. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Mark. And just to say that for most people in the room that are not staffers, there's a thing called an election on Tuesday, which means some of these people might lose their jobs. And I'm in the same position. I'm one of the few people that know in the year's time I'm not going to be working for the Prime Minister because the Prime Minister is going to be changing. So politics has a real impact on what we're talking about today for a whole load of people. I want to talk about two things today. One is I want to try and say some of the main things that have gone on in the English NHS reform programme. But secondly, I want to try and relate that to an issue that we've been talking about for the last couple of days, which is specifically how we increase value in healthcare systems. And one of the books that have been talked about really over the last couple of days, this book by Michael Porter on redefining healthcare, has acted as a sort of bridge, quite a useful bridge between a critique of American healthcare system around competition and the way in which we're trying to organise competition in other healthcare systems. And so for the first time, I think, we've got a way of talking about competition that exists within, in my case, a completely socialised healthcare system, but which is trying to move towards competition within that framework, and competition that exists in the American model in a private healthcare system, and trying to make sense of how value creation works in very different systems. So the first thing to say, since the heading of what we're talking about in this session is lessons Americans might care to learn, is that I don't think I, and probably my colleague from Australia, is not talking about that you need to take on an entire system approach that we've got in socialized medicine in order to learn these lessons. I think the thing that has to come out, and there's an awful word that we've been using over the last 3 days, which is a word called systemness. If you've not got a system, it's very difficult to do things. If you have got a system, then there's certain things that you can begin to talk about. And certainly, I think in listening to the IT issues in the last session, I think it must be it's a puzzle to me how we are standing in a nation where there is more IT in people's homes than any other in the world, but less in their healthcare system than almost any other in the world. And that, I think, comes in part from not having a system. So what I want to talk about today is how we are reforming our system, but maintaining it as a system. And some of the things are to do with the nature of the basic background issues of the NHS. The NHS has is much more than a health system for the people of England. It represents a set of social, human and moral relationships between the country and itself. It is what one of my previous Secretary of State used to call the best gift the British people have ever made to itself. And because of that, it has a set of meanings which goes beyond the healthcare system. It actually, in some ways, is to the British people what the American Constitution is to the American people, in that it means something about the nature of who we are. And certainly in talking to Canadians, one of the ways in which they define themselves, one of the most important things for Canadians is not being Americans, and one of the most ways in which they define themselves as not being American is having a socialized healthcare system. So what we are talking about with this particular healthcare system is something that goes beyond healthcare. And we now have in British political society an agreement of all three major political parties that the way in which we formulate healthcare out of taxation, free at the point of need with equal access for all, is the way in which this will happen at least for another 15 years. So what we're doing is reforming something that people really love. They don't just like it a bit, they really love, and it defines who they are. And if you're doing that, you have to be careful. Because this is the nature of our society, not just a healthcare system. So we start off with an immense warm relationship with this system, and actually, secondarily, people would rather like it if it gave them some healthcare. So those two things, why the New Labour government came in 1987 and has tried to reform healthcare with some sort of passion and zeal, is we rather passionately believe in this system of organising health, but actually are deeply worried that it doesn't seem to provide very good healthcare. And the sorts of thing we heard from Roger Boyle in a previous session is dramatic improvements in the nature of healthcare for people with heart disease, but because we started from a very bad base. So we had this system which desperately needed reform, and we have a necessity to change that reform, partly because we believe so passionately in the nature of that system. And that's why English people talking about healthcare systems are a bit odd, because they do have a passion for a particular form of a system, but equally, they're very critical of the way in which that system operates. And that's the nature of the reform program that we're dealing with. And so there was an absolute necessity of reform in 1997, that the system was in many ways out of synchronization with the way in which people experience most other services in their society. In our society, there was very, very powerful professions that actually recreated their power through maintaining very crucial shortages of labour. So we've only recently, just in the last few months, started to get a labour market of doctors. And doctors don't like it. It's the same as plumbers. If there's a labour market of plumbers, then actually plumbers can't charge as much as they want to, and the same is true with doctors. For the first time in the last few months, we are beginning to see a labour market emerge, and that is an active part of policy, that if you don't have sufficient doctors, it's not just you have insufficient capacity, but you don't have the possibility of putting through changes which doctors can block. And so one of the things about the systemness I think I'm talking about today is having a system, having an organisational framework, having in our case a government pushing that organisational framework, gives you the possibility of taking on very powerful vested interests that would stop that reform. So systemness for me starts off needing something which is above the profession and above pharmaceutical industries and above the providers of healthcare to actually say this system needs to be changed. The private healthcare system in Britain, incidentally, has been even more changed by the government's NHS reforms than the public healthcare system. We have succeeded in constructing, and this is where Porter's book is very interesting for the English situation, we had a private healthcare system where there was virtually no competition and where fees for doctors were the highest in the world. Because we came in as a state and constructed new forms of independent providers of healthcare, we constructed some competition against the nature of against the existing private healthcare system. So one of the things we've done is change the nature of private healthcare through constructing competition. I'm going to go through the three main activities that we've the activities of the reform program that have changed the nature of the NHS. First of all, we've developed the way in which demand is understood. Our equivalent of insurance is population-based organisations called primary care trusts. They receive money which is collected nationally through national taxation and is distributed through a formula which specifically recognises almost for the first time that there are certain areas with a higher burden of disease and a higher set of needs. So the money is distributed to, if you like, poorer areas. More money is distributed to poorer areas than better off areas. These people then commission health for their localities. The general practitioners that we've heard a lot about are over the next year being put in charge of the budget for their local area. And this begins to be one of the major drivers of change. Because if we believe that people could be treated better nearer to home and cheaper nearer to home, then putting people in charge of the budget who are doing that treating nearer to home will provide them with an incentive, a direct incentive, to get treatment nearer to home rather than expensive hospitals. And it seems to be one of the problems you are looking at in the American system is providing an incentive for people all the time to go for the most expensive treatment. We have got, through providing general practitioners with most of the budget in the UK, the recognition that if they can save some of that budget and reinvest it, then it's in their interest not necessarily to go for the most expensive treatment, but to go for treatment nearer to home. Alongside that, we're providing patients with more choice. And we've heard some interesting things over the last couple of days about patients in some ways not being interested in information about choice. We worked very clearly in providing an offer to patients that if they were waiting for a long period of time, then they had to they were provided with an offer of being able to choose to go somewhere else. Under those circumstances, a simple piece of information, how long am I waiting, can I go somewhere quicker, yes, that's not a difficult thing. People chose over 60% to go to somewhere else with that information. So if you're offering choice, this is a tip. It's not a bad idea to offer people choice about something that interests them rather than something that interests us. If waiting times matters to the public, then let's do it about that. If other things matter to the public, then let's do it about that. If actually some form of qualitative data matters to us and not to them, then it's not surprising they don't use it. So if we want them to be interested in certain sorts of data, we have to make it their data. So, for example, there's a database being developed by a general practitioner in Yorkshire, which is collecting anecdotes about hospitals. Not league tables, but anecdotes about hospitals, because that's the data that people use when they make sense of things. So rather than constructing our own forms of this data, if we want people interested in quality, it might just be what the person down the road said about it, rather than what we all say about it. Moving on, in not just looking at the development of demand, we've transformed the way in which supply is constructed as well. One of the alarming things for English people was to find out that the Secretary of State owned all the hospitals in England, and that therefore the notion of constructing any independence of those hospitals when actually they're owned by Whitehall was virtually nil. So we've constructed a new independent form of public hospital called Foundation Trusts, and they are operating much more as businesses in searching out some form of business amongst patients. So you've got an active, for the first time, an active set of organisations in public hospitals. We've also created a new form of private organisation called Independent Sector Treatment Centres, which are where people have all of their treatment paid for by the NHS in exactly the same way as in public hospitals, but these are bringing in new ways of carrying out activities and changing the productivity. And so for the first time, we have brought in completely foreign, literally foreign ways of carrying out sets of activities which have different productivity bases and are therefore teaching the NHS how to do things. We're bringing in new forms of providers in GP services as well. So in developing demand, we're also developing supply, and those of you with an understanding of economics will recognise if you're doing those two things, then you have to develop the transactional relationships between them. And the way in which finance was organised in the NHS was not one where there was any transparency. One of the abiding lessons I learned from a book by Americans Osborne and Gabler in the early 1990s is they said, wouldn't it be a good idea if public service organizations had to earn money rather than just spend it? They have a difficult enough job just spending it, right? But wouldn't it be interesting if organizations have to... We are now constructing a situation where the nation's hospitals have to earn money rather than just spend it. And that is transforming the way in which they think about things and transforming the main thing I want to talk about, which is the way in which the value chain needs to be conceptualized. What is interesting, again, about international healthcare conferences is that there is a sort of despair, a looming despair, that it's inevitable that the increase in technology is going to mean much more cost. There is no other service industry that would have that assumption. Every other service industry would look to technology to decrease costs. But we seem to just be stuck in a way of looking at increased technologies, oh, that's going to cost us more money. And that looming despair is a real problem for healthcare economics, because it's just taken as a natural assumption that as we get clever at saving people's lives, it's going to somehow cost us more money. And if we looked at the nature of technology and looked at how that might change the terms of trade, then I think we'd see there are these three different ways in which we can change value. And that's where, to use Porter's point, we need to put the pressure points to bring about competition. The first is in hospitals. I mean, there are very, very few hospitals, it seems to me, in the world where the inefficiencies in most of the world's hospitals are of heroic proportions. And when we talk about 3 or 4%, it's actually, when you look at the figures that Mark Berg came up with, it's between 35 and 40%, the level of these inefficiencies. And any other service would not have put up with this for some time. So we need pressure points on the nature of those services. The second thing we need is we've got to understand how we can prevent the misuse of hospital services. That's why we've given the general practitioners the budgets, to ensure that they're incentivized to create much more value by limiting the inappropriate hospitalization. The third thing is we have to prevent, in terms of preventative medicine, most of the preventative work around health isn't medicine. Most of preventative work about health is to do with lifestyle issues. And we have to drive competition in there where people helping people to prevent ill health are primarily not doctors. They're primarily not expensive doctors. They're primarily cheap advice agents. And if we saw the preventative of ill health primarily involving community and voluntary organizations, then we can increase the value outcomes there. So my three points I'll leave you with is that if we look at those areas where value is most wasted, and actually that ascends as we go down that list, then we can decrease the amount of doctors' involvement, increase the amount of value on each of those three areas. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. Thanks for getting us off to a provocative start. Our next speaker is Alan Fels of Australia.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to congratulate the Commonwealth Fund on having this excellent conference. Australia happens to have come out fairly well on quite a few of the comparisons, so I thought I would emphasise how our system actually is not so perfect by mentioning mental health. But before that, competition has been mentioned a lot, and I'm not a health specialist, but I was chairman of our competition commission in Australia, and I had many adventures with the health sector, which I'll just like to briefly mention. We have quite a big private component to our medical system, and doctors generally paid on a fee for service basis. Actually, I published an article in the newspapers once where I tried to rank the different professions in terms of how good they were at applying economics, and gave the medical profession 10 out of 10. First of all, they were smart enough to establish a monopoly no one can compete with them, and then to restrict entry into the profession as much as possible so that only a few people shared the monopoly profits. I then compared them with the lawyers, who got 5 out of 10 because in a whole lot of areas they managed to get a monopoly, but they forgot to restrict entry, and so there's a flood of people who came in competing away the delicious monopoly profits. And then my own humble profession of economics got 0 out of 10 because we did none of those things. Now, actually, just going back to medicine, though, I'd give them quite often a bit more than 10 out of 10 because not only have those limitations been quite traditional in many countries, but also, even having got that, usually there are further restrictions on competition between people in the profession. For example, lots of fields of specialisation are restricted from others doing them. And there's also lots of anti-competitive arrangements on prices and prohibitions on advertising and informing the public and so on. Well, against that background, about 10 years ago, Australia applied the competition law to the health sector and the medical profession. And, of course, our commission immediately went into educational mode, no effect. Warning mode, no effect. Fortunately, the anaesthetists came to our rescue. They had a meeting at which they agreed to introduce a at-call charge. That means that they mightn't be in the hospital, but they'd be available to come into the hospital. They might be at home or on their yacht or whatever, but they should be able to charge for that. Now, there's nothing wrong in principle with an at-call charge, but it's illegal for competitors to agree on this, and we told them that. They, to our secret delight, ignored that, so we were able to take them to court and get a very good precedent from the court saying, well, the law does apply to you, and then we're able to go on and prosecute the Australian Medical Association for price fixing and a whole lot of other really entertaining cases. But we did want to go into things a bit more deeply than that, into the entry restrictions side, and we investigated surgeons, and we concluded that although there were some justifications for restricting who could be a surgeon and so on in terms of protecting quality and making sure that not anyone can perform brain surgery, nevertheless, it was clear that the restrictions on entry had a considerable extra element to restrict competition to increase incomes, and indeed was an important cause of shortages of surgeons in various parts of Australia, especially in country areas. So we again said off to court with you lot, and this time there will be a big fine. Now, they decided to, having seen the other court cases, they decided to what's called apply for authorisation of the arrangements. And so we had a big investigation of it, and we concluded, okay, it's fair enough to have exams and things of that sort, but you have to free up entry, and you have to make the system more acceptable in terms of fairness and things like that, and to get rid of anti-competitive elements. We had some success on that, but I should also say that we had pretty mixed support from governments over it. Our agency got terribly stiff warnings and threats from the then Health Minister, Mr. Waldridge, who threatened everything over this, and also many of the state governments who privately complained about these things totally went to water when we had a public inquiry in it, and that limited the things that we were actually able to do. But we did do a number of things to improve the situation. Now, there isn't time to go into all of this, but I'll just make a couple of points. We just heard from Paul about the benefits of opening up competition. That's true. What always happens if you open up competition and money is involved is that there are immense forces at work to try to make sure that doesn't happen from within the industry. It's very important to have a competition law to stop some of the blatant practices. And all the practices that we dealt with in our time had nothing to do with questions about the quality of medicine, the fiduciary relationship of patient and doctor ethical questions. They all involved a naked use of market power to extract higher income from consumers and the government. And, okay, so that's very briefly comment on that. Perhaps one other point. We have also found that within the workforce, more generally in the health sector, there are massive restrictive practices which hugely inhibit efficiency and flexibility. That is, restrictions on who can do what and things of that sort. And as the financial pressure comes on the system, we need to look at a whole lot. We had much mention of this conference, slightly to my disappointment, and that's mental health. Mental health is one of the black spots of the Australian system. I think there are two black spots. There's that and there's Indigenous health. And of Indigenous health, I'll say no more than that a serious component of that is severe mental illness questions there. But going back to mental health more generally, maybe Australia is not so different from many other countries. Mental health performance is pretty poor. Over half our prison population are people with mental illness. As you all know, the prisons are the new mental asylums. A high proportion of the homeless in Australia are people with mental illness. High proportion of drug addicts have mental health problems, quite high suicide rates for mentally ill people, including young people. Many people are not treated at all. There are severe problems in the whole mental health system. And of course, the history is familiar everywhere. Deinstitutionalisation was instituted, but there was a gross underestimation of the needs of caring for mentally ill people once they were put back into the community. And those needs are everywhere. There are deficiencies in the level of medical and psychiatric care, in psychosocial care, in residential provision for mentally ill. There are employment problems. There is a massive stigma that still continues, and so on. And what's the cause of these problems? Well, there are multiple causes, but I'll just mention one or two. One is, basically, it is a very low political priority. And perhaps I could give you a couple of stories. In my own school, where there are lots of public servants, I talk to people. Now, there's someone who is in charge of disability in her state, and I asked, does that include mental illness? Certainly. In theory, it does, but we never go near that. We only do physical disability. Why? That would open the floodgates. It would be uncontrollable, massive demands on the government to do something. We keep well away from that. And there's no political pressure to change. Second, health ministers tell me it's a very low priority. They don't feel under any political pressure to act. Well, recently it's had a somewhat higher priority, and the Commonwealth has stepped up the funding. Our Prime Minister is talking about it as a problem, and they are starting to do something. But it's going to be a long time before 30 years of neglect are made up for. I'm concerned that this will be a one-off attention to the issue, and then political attention will move on to other issues and be forgotten for another 10 years. The system works much better for the so-called worried well than for the really seriously mentally ill people. One good thing that's going on, I think, is that there's fairly heavy interest now in early intervention to deal with mental illness. I'll give that the benefit of the doubt as a good policy to spend money on. But there are other respects in which there are policy problems. And because of time, I'll just mention one or two. One is, as again we heard from Paul, you have to have a system. Now, mental illness raises questions for the health, for the police, for education, for homeless, for housing policy, employment policy, and so on. And it's very hard to get it dealt with as a system. And secondly, the fact that it's being dealt with by many different levels of government also means that it's really complicated to get coherent solutions or to measure performance. I also have studied things right down there at grassroots level at some units that deal with mentally ill people, and even the better ones are pretty terrible. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Alan. Going down the table, now we'll have our discussants, and Mark Hayes from the... What do you want? You want Sabell to go? Should we have Sabell go for it? You guys are too polite. You can sit right there if you prefer, but let's start with just going in order, Mark Hayes and then Sabell.
Thank you very much. Well, thanks for the opportunity to be here and for hearing these great presentations. I think it's a great opportunity for us to examine how other systems are grappling with some of the same kinds of issues we are really grappling with in the United States. And it's what's really interesting to me in looking at the materials and preparing for today and in listening to these presentations is how there really is quite a bit of commonality around the challenges that we're facing, even though the systems and really the culture around how healthcare is provided is really different in these different countries. But there's certainly some striking differences in how we've dealt with those problems and how we are far behind in the United States in some ways. We have a lot less health IT being used, and I think that that was discussed earlier, but it's really very striking the difference in the adoption of information technology in the United States. And I think it was said well that we have more computers in people's homes than we do in healthcare. And that's something that we've really got to change. We have got to get the standards in place so the computers can all talk to each other and we can have better care coordination. I think it was great how this was framed in the context of supply and demand issues. We have, no question, our own supply issues, and we could spend days talking about the supply issues in the United States when you factor in the combination of public and private delivery systems that we have in this country and how they fit together in many times really well, and in many times they don't fit together very well. But on the demand side, we also have some really big challenges in that I think the U.S. consumer generally is known for wanting instant access to everything. You know, we're into fast food, and we want to drive through the drive-through window for many of our meals, or put everything else in the microwave, and if it takes more than 4 or 5 minutes before it comes out, you know, we're very impatient with it. Now, you know, sometimes on the weekends we get a little more creative and we like to do cooking and things like that, but I think that's our image anyway as the U.S. consumers. We want everything right away. And I think it's that way when it comes to demand as well, and this kind of comes out in some of this data about after-hours care and the inability to find access to after-hours care drives a lot of people to use the emergency room and the costs that are there. But we also, in the United States, I think we demand really high quality. The problem is we don't know what high quality is, and we rely on this competition to determine how our healthcare system is going to function, but our consumers don't have the tools to know what is good cost and what is good quality. That's something that we're really trying to address with some emphasis on consumer-directed healthcare and by putting more information out into the marketplace. And for people, like probably a lot of people in this room that have health coverage, you know, we don't pay anything different regardless of where we go a lot of times. The same cost sharing applies no matter what primary care doctor I go to. Many of the people in the United States are in PPOs, preferred provider organizations, right? And you can go to almost any provider and be assured of similar out-of-pocket costs. Or where there are differences, there's no way to know before you go into the system. So we have to help consumers understand what quality is, and then we have to make sure that the payers are actually paying for that quality, because our payment system doesn't reward quality, and so it's not part of the business model in this country. And it sounds to me like some of those same issues are being grappled with in the systems we've talked about here this afternoon, that in terms of how do you structure the payment systems to reward efficient, high-quality care is a lot of the similar kind of discussion that we're having. I also found it very interesting that it sounds like while we are in the United States grappling with competition and how to make competition work, both of these systems sound like they're trying to inject more competition, inject competition between providers to show more quality or to provide that access to local health services, rather than looking for the more expensive service we heard. Lastly, just a reaction about mental health, because that came up at the end. That seems like a global concern as well, and I think I hear a lot of commonality on the issues that were raised around how we're facing mental health issues in the United States. You know, we have a system that doesn't provide parity on mental health benefits across all payment systems, and there is a stigma attached to mental illness that shouldn't be there. And in today's world, where we have such a better understanding now of the organic causes of mental illness, that stigma is such a long-standing problem. I guess it's going to take a long time for it to go away. But we really, as a society, I think all of us need to face up to how we provide better treatment for mental illness. So that's what I would say in reaction to what I've heard, and I'm looking forward to hearing Sabelle's comments and the discussion we'll have afterwards. Thanks again.
Thank you, Mark.
Sabelle?
Excuse me. Thank you, and thanks as always to the Commonwealth Fund and the Alliance for this event. I look forward to it every year. My only regret was that I couldn't be here all morning, but like Mark, I trolled through the papers, and it looks like there was a lot of interesting discussion. And I think in terms of the original title of our session, Lessons to be Learned, by any stretch of the imagination, we have a tremendous amount to learn, not only from other countries, But even lessons in terms of IT and quality improvement and other things from some of the systems in our own country. If you look at the strides that our veteran system has made in the last decade, across the board, they've had progress in a lot of areas. And I guess that brings me to my next point, which is that absent a universal coverage system of some sort, and not that we can necessarily import anybody else's direct system to ours, but absent something where everybody has coverage and we can minimize some of the fractured nature of our system, I think our progress in all these fronts is likely to be quite limited. But there are certainly a lot of improvements that we can and should be tackling in the interim. And like Mark, I'd say what I find very interesting, especially with the panelists that are up here with us, but also in general, that in these other countries where you have universal coverage, you are still struggling with some of the same issues we're struggling with. So I know it's not a silver bullet, but it'd be a vast improvement over our current status quo to at least get everybody covered and try to start approximating systemness here. At the risk of sounding unpatriotic, I often tell visiting delegations when I have the opportunity to talk with folks who are coming over from other countries to talk things, who say, well, we're looking at some of the aspects of your system and thinking of doing them. Don't follow our lead. Most of them are thinking about it, so it's preaching to the choir. But certainly there are a lot of things in our system that are admirable and work well, but it's a multi-tiered system and tremendously inefficient. We have a terrible bang for the buck, if you will, with tremendous spending by any measure and a fairly low return on investment when you look at our indicators. So it's always interesting to try to see what the other countries are doing. Competition, I think, is a double-edged sword. You've got certainly some areas in which it can help drive a positive evolution in a system. But I think you have to be very cognizant of the limits of healthcare and how it is not a traditional economic market. Purchasing healthcare is simply not an economic market like purchasing other durable goods and services. And there's got to be a firm understanding of the limited expectations of what is the flavor of the day around here these days in terms of consumer-directed healthcare. Getting patients information about cost and quality is a good thing, but for the most part, patients don't drive a lot of the healthcare decision making in the system. As one of my bosses says, you go to the doctor, you take the test he says that you should take, and you hope you pass. I you know, don't think a lot of people gratuitously like to take time off from work, go sit in a waiting room, see the doctor, just because they're lonely and looking for something to do. I do think, you know, there is probably a bit of a worried well aspect to some of this, but it's, and Mark is right to highlight the immediacy in terms of demand from American consumers and their immediate look of disdain at Canada, the UK, or somewhere else when they think of queues. But I think we have to have a very real expectation about the limitations around this notion of information driving the individual patient very far. You have the pre-existing relationships in our system as well, where if you take, for example, being pregnant, I like my OB practice. I think that they're good. I don't have any quality indicators, but everybody I know goes there, and that's unfortunately the best I can do right now. They delivered my other child. I'm not about to switch OB providers. They only practice at one hospital. So I don't really care what the other hospitals in my network are performing as, because I'm not going to change my OB just for the delivery. And I think that that's indicative of it's you know, the relationships that a lot of patients have with their physicians. Your physician or the primary care person is your front line with the system, and the relationships that they have with the hospitals and that both of them have with your insurer really are what drive where you go these days. And so I think information can be very useful, but I think expecting a lot of it to drive the actual patient behavior is probably overly ambitious. It should be directed more at the payers and the frontline providers. The thing, if I paraphrase Mr. Corrigan right, about systemness needing to rise above special interests, I couldn't agree more. I think there's little chance in the U.S. of that happening in our current environment. It's very hard. And I think any time we look at a major reform effort here, whether within a system we already have or back in 93, 94, trying to move forward, you threaten very robust industries, and that can mitigate our ability to move forward on some of these things. I think my time is up, and I'd rather have a discussion, but I just would thank everybody for coming here today. I think there's a lot of interesting topics.
Well, thank you for your comments. Let me open this up now to questions from the floor. And I think we have some microphones around if anybody has questions. Can I see a hand up back here and another over here? Go right ahead.
Barry McCormick, UK Department of Health. We had a very interesting discussion yesterday on the organizations that provide a portal for new technologies and pharma coming into some European countries. And the discussion tended to end with the view that perhaps this wouldn't work in North America. The notion of denying certain technologies or pharmas to the UK was just not part of the American tradition. And I want to offer an interpretation of that possibility that perhaps is slightly different, and ask for the views of the group. The philosophy that Alex Cesar offered us was one of providing additional information to enable quality transparency, to make competition in the American labor, in the American health market more effective. I wonder whether or not the role of the American NICE might be not to say yes to certain pharmas and technologies and no to others, but to provide information about effectively the quality value of different pharmas and technologies, and to enable the insurance market to work more efficiently than it presently works. At present, it seems to the outsider that Americans are reluctant to buy anything but the most expensive, most generous, fully coveraged form of insurance, and are afraid to buy the second best policy for fear that that denies them very valuable technologies and farmers. Is it not possible that an American NICE wouldn't give consumers the confidence to buy the second priced policy, which may be considerably less than the most expensive policy, in the confidence that it had been assessed by an organization and certain farmers and technologies which have quality values that are very high but not extremely high would be available to them under that insurance system? So within the American philosophy, isn't it possible that a NICE would enable the insurance market to become more efficient?
So what about it? Comments on whether an American NICE that focused on providing objective information to give consumers confidence in making decisions to get more high-value health care would work? Maybe we could call it NICER.
I think the interesting thing about that is that for the American people, such an organization exists, and it's called the English NICE, in that actually there are several million hits from Americans looking at what NICE suggests, because it gives them some validation. But I think Barry's got a point, that the validation that comes from across the Atlantic wouldn't be a validation that comes from here would actually mean something for people, because they'd know, and we know in England, how the decisions were made and the involvement of citizens' panels and all sorts of things. But it is providing good, clear information around the relationship between cost and quality and outcome, I think would assist this problem you've got of everybody playing safe and going for the most expensive.
Comment quickly that we would love to have an American version of NICE, and have talked about it. There's been a lot of rhetoric, very few dollars. One of the agencies that had begun to do some of that work a number of years ago was practically eliminated when the Republicans took control of our Congress. It's been built back with bipartisan support, but yeah, again, you're running up against tremendous industries here. And you know, it's a battle of the titans of the insurance industry, private insurers who would like to have some of this information, I think, the public payers, and the technology developers who don't want product A compared with product B. And so I think we're starting to make some steps toward it, and we need it. I would say, though, I think that our consumers, NICE would help policymakers and payers make better coverage decisions. But our consumers, when they're buying insurance, most are not looking behind at the specific technology that's covered, and probably with the exception of our Medicare beneficiaries who are shopping by formularies, they're not even looking at formularies. They're looking at more of the benefit structure and co-payments and other things. So I think it's important to have an American analog to NICE for a whole lot of reasons. I don't know that it necessarily dictates American consumers' purchase of their insurance product.
I think another problem that we have is that a lot of consumers in this country don't actually have any choice of coverage. And so, with you know, we have exceptions to that. We have this federal employees program in which people that work for the government, like we do, you know, you get a lot of different plans you can choose from. So you can start to try to look for the second best plan, for example, if that has a price benefit for you, a lower premium. So if you don't want the Cadillac plan or don't feel like you need it, then that's a choice you can make. And it may not even be an informed decision on the difference between one technology or another technology and what's covered, but it might be. If it's something that you need, if you know you already take, you're going to, I think consumers are very good at looking to see if their plan is going to cover that. And that's the second point I want to make, is that because I think in our country so much of the coverage is employer-sponsored, that these decisions have ramifications for employers that we don't maybe have in other countries, because an employer gets very concerned if you're going to change the plan you provide to your workers and really cut back on benefits or change the formulary or really be a lot more aggressive on cost controls, because you may have a backlash from the people that work for you. It may affect productivity for your company. So we also have a relationship there that we can't ignore, too.
And as more information becomes available, our consumers certainly are looking at it more and more. This is an active issue here. The Institute of Medicine, our Institute of Medicine has been studying it, and Gail Walensky, who was here earlier, is, I think, going to be have that for the discussion paper in an upcoming issue of our journal Health Affairs, where there will be a lot of perspectives on do we need more effort here. I think most people think yes, and should it be a public entity? Should it be a private entity? Should it be a public-private entity? So a lot of discussion around this now. Very good question. Yes, sir.
My name is Rick Blake. I'm working with Congressman Towns from New York. We represent the nation of Brooklyn. And I think there's somewhat of an unreality, particularly in the district of ours. I mean, Mark, you were talking about people who have health insurance. And employed, our district is 50% unemployed with 48% using the emergency room as our only source of health care. So if we're going to impact any of this stuff, we have to reduce health disparities. I mean, you're talking about technology. Okay, you know, most of our people, you know, don't have computers. So, I realize there's a lot of goodwill in this room, and I'm not going to be, partisan or anything like that. But I think really when it comes to doing this, if we're talking about fixing things, we need to develop a systematic approach to working with poor people.
That's very well taken. I mean, there's no single silver bullet to any of these issues, and I think one of the biggest challenges we have is on all of these things, taking into account how it affects different populations. No question.
Yes. Peter, where are the microphones? I need Peter.
About what Paul Corrigan said. I was wondering whether implicitly in your story there was a sort of lost decade here, because in the early 90s you did have GP fund holders, you had trust hospitals, these were wound back, and now they're being, and now admittedly a more collectivized version is being put in their place. Do you think that there might have been more progress had increased funding but those initiatives from the previous administration be taken forward?
I think
I think there's some quite distinct differences between what we're trying to do and what the previous government was trying to do, to pick up the point that was made before, is that we're trying to move the whole thing forward at once, and fund holders were trying to move forward the bit that wanted to do it and that were working with a particular area. So this was the fact that GPs could actually have their own funds that we are moving to now, but we're moving to for everybody. I think equally, the interesting thing that, that the previous administration would admit is that there was a loss of nerve about independent trusts, because any politician has an ambivalent relationship about losing control. And what the government had said is that we're going to give trusts the right to control, and then they thought, well, actually, we no longer run the system. And the way in which we've dealt with that is by passing a piece of legislation that stops us from being able to do it, because actually, given half a chance, politicians will always interfere. So in constructing, there's a point to what you're saying, that we should have picked up on that and changed it straight away rather than just rolled it back. I think we should have gone for foundation trust and much more independence earlier. And I think probably if not a lost decade, there's probably a lost 5 years. But the crucial time is not losing the nerve now, when there's a fair amount of turbulence in the system. Because one of the things that people outside of the NHS may not realise is that the very long waits we had meant that people who were running a hospital had a guaranteed set of work for the 2 years to come. So they had no risk whatsoever. The people who had the risk were the patients. And we transferred a portion of that risk into the system. And the system is now experiencing some turbulence that it never did before, because it doesn't know where its work's coming from. It actually has to go out and try and gain it. And so that transfer of risk from patients that didn't know who they were going to be treated by, when they were going to be treated, or what was going to happen to them, has actually meant the system now experiences that. Some of that risk, and that's why it's kicking back quite a bit.
Thank you. I think we have time for one more question. Go ahead.
My name is Mindy Steinberg. I'm with the National Breast Cancer Coalition. And my question is more for the panelists from overseas. It's becoming increasingly part of the health care reform debate in this country, the role of consumer and patient advocates in that debate. And I'm just wondering what role consumer advocates play in your countries in terms of changing the healthcare system or just being part of it in general?
Well, the consumer advocates have a pretty limited effect. Governments are now starting to impose consumer consultation requirements on hospitals around the country. But the most powerful effect is through dollars, where consumers are in charge of dollar spending, or where their agents are in charge. That tends to move things more than anything. I guess that would be my take on it. I do perceive a slowly changing ambience in the whole of medicine in Australia, and I think around the world, where the consumer is starting to become relatively more important in the past for many reasons, including additional information, changed cultural outlooks towards doctors as gods and things of that sort.
I think with us, the consumer advocate organisations that also develop into low-level service provision are having really quite an impact. So we have an organisation called UK Diabetes that actually doesn't just say we need more money spent on diabetes, care about us. It actually organises people with diabetes to care more, to self-manage more. And so we as a health service want to work with them because we then want to increase self-management. And a lot of the big charities, and your equivalent, Breakthrough Breast Cancer in the UK, is now working not just saying we need more money spent on breast cancer, but this is how we can help you deliver services. because the essence of everything we've been talking about is if patients are not involved in the delivery of those services, the services deliver badly. So consumer advocate groups assist the medical profession by empowering the patient rather than just leaving them as individuals. So you have a collective patient that will be arguing for a better service and delivering that better service to themselves rather than just, in a sense, standing outside and just arguing, just lobbying from the outside. So it's a combination of lobbying plus provision that I think is beginning to change their power relationship.
Well, I would like to thank all of you for taking time this afternoon and especially for your excellent questions. I'd like to especially thank our panelists for their efforts here today and coming all the way to this conference, despite having some very busy jobs back home, and our distinguished discussants, who I hope will both have jobs after the election. And I'm sure they will. They're doing great work. Thank you all for joining us. It's been an excellent discussion about issues on both the demand side, the consumer involvement, the supply side, and provider involvement to get to a higher performance healthcare system and to make sure that it's performing well for everyone in that system. Thank you all very much.
It's all over except for my shouting. And I'll start with a couple of mechanical announcements. First, I hope you'll complete your evaluations and return them. Outside at the front table is a blue sign in English for where you can drop them. And for those of you who have buses through the International Symposium, just follow the staff. There's one that will go to Dulles that will leave promptly when I'm done at about 1:45, and another that will go to the Hay Adams and then to Reagan Airport that will leave at the same time. I think I'm going to cut my thanks short. Technically, I could thank absolutely everybody who's either in this room or has been in this room or was in the rooms with us in the last 2 days. I do want to say just a word of thanks to three groups of staff. One is the Funds International Program, which works very hard to put together this whole symposium. Second is our partners, the Alliance for Health Reform, who organized today's events and, as always, did a superb job with it. And the third is fund-sponsored staff who are based here in Washington at Academy Health and who also lent their hands to making this symposium work. And I think one more special one is to Kathy Shane, Robin Osborne, and the Harris Organization, who do the survey that is the centerpiece of the symposium. With that, let me just take you on a quick tour through my impressions of, and I don't know how I get this privilege, but you're a little bit stuck with me. We noticed that the survey of primary care physicians showed wide differences across countries. They were in four areas: clinical information systems, access, coordination of care, and care for persons with chronic conditions. Now, the fact is that one way to interpret these survey results is that we all, maybe with the exception of Denmark and the ambulatory side, have room to improve. Some countries are doing better than others, but nobody's really perfect. And there are lots of missed opportunities. Systems matter. And there are striking differences in our approaches. And I would say not only can we, but we must learn from each other. And that, I hope, has been a theme of this meeting. One thing that didn't come up, but is implicit in what I've said so far, is that I don't think we discuss well enough when performance is good enough. And the question is whether or not you all believe, or any of us believe, that near perfection in healthcare is unattainable. We behave as if we believe that it's unattainable, but I don't understand why healthcare should be different. And until we have a notion of perfection, I think we're not going to really achieve high-performance health systems. And so we really need to start thinking about what it takes to achieve perfect care, both within healthcare organizations and across entire healthcare systems. We released a scorecard, actually our Commission on a High Performance Health System did, in the end of September. And it gave scores for U.S. performance and widely reported they were in the 60-70% range. I want to give you one example showing you that even in this country, as imperfect as we've been said to be for the last 2 days, it is we are capable of improvement. So if you look at this slide, which shows not 10 years of data, thanks to the National Committee for Quality Assurance, on use of beta blockers among patients who are in commercial health plans in this country, you would see that back in 1996, when the top 10th percentile was performing at the 87% level, and the country's mean across of these was around 60-something percent, that our score would have been about 70%, or about what we're currently getting on our overall scorecard. But if you look at what it is in 2005, just reported about a month ago, you see that the top performers, top deciles now performing at the 100% level, that the average across these health plans is now 96.6%, and basically the score is now up to 97. It is possible to do this. You must keep it in mind. We must strive for perfection. There was a lot of discussion about goals for a high-performance health system. The ministers discussed this yesterday. They focused on the center of the box, which is really cross-cutting, getting long, healthy, and productive lives. They found some of the other boxes a little too medical and thought that it's important to remember the interface between public health system, the community, and the medical side of things. We've had a lot of discussion about incentives, about how do we get doctors and others to do something. And we talked primarily about external motivators. We could have talked a little about internal motivators as well. And I'd say we are at an embryonal stage of understanding how best to stimulate the workers in our health systems to change. Here are a couple of models that have been talked about in the last couple of days. We've heard of fees for service. The downside is the hamster aspect of it. But the upside, as Ibn Johansen was talking about this morning, is that if you pay twice as much for each service of writing an email rather than a telephone call, you get much more, many more emails done. So it's one way of dealing with motivation. Capitation, we worry about people sort of hibernating and not delivering services. And then there's pay for performance, in which my friend Don Berwick would like to say we behave like trained SEALs, but SEALs usually look happy. Here we have, we had a very nice panel yesterday on drug policy, and Jonathan Lomas pointed out to us that there were two poles in this discussion, that one could do randomized controlled trials for everything and come out with very precise data, that conversely you could put your finger up to the wind and just make a decision, and that the emerging national processes were somewhere in between. And I just want to point out that it's generally hotter in the middle of the world than it is at the two poles. And we had a couple of descriptions of what the middle looks like. And it's pretty complicated. Mix of scientific evidence, judgment, altruism, self-interest in politics, et cetera, which Andreas Lopakis from Canada pictured it as. And yet Arnie Epstein commented that slowly but surely, stumbling or not, mostly stumbling, I think, we're making progress in drug decision-making. And I thought one thing we didn't talk about was how can single countries, even large ones, negotiate or deal successfully with large multinational corporations. That seemed to me to be the 900-pound gorilla that was in the middle of the room and not addressed. We had a lot of talk about patient-centeredness at this symposium and meeting even today. And this is one view of the patient at the center, bewildered, having to be their own contractor and put together their own care. It's not, I think, the kind of view that any of us would like to have of patient-centeredness. We got into a very nice discussion about chronic disease management yesterday. Jack Rose summarized it beautifully, pointed out it requires identifying the right patients, that involves progressive movement of care to the community, that there's a need for care plans, that one has to have an electronic and other kind of system infrastructure to support it, that remote monitoring will become more and more and more important and will be a growth area, probably a profitable one for those who are in that kind of technology, and that, again, it was a patient-centered kind of thing that we were talking about as we were talking about addressing patients who have multiple chronic conditions or even single significant chronic conditions. This didn't come from this conference. About a week ago at the International Society for Quality meeting, an award was given on patient-centered care to the Plaintree Organization, which is a membership organization of healthcare organizations in this country, and they're very much into patient-centered care. They have a very nice little model about what it should be, and it's PhD. It should be personalized, humanized, and demystified. And if you think about that, I think in virtually all of the contexts of organizing care, one ought to be able to make the care considerably more patient-centered. Just a few minutes ago, we heard that you really have to have a system in order to have a health system, and the government needs to either push or shape that system, and I just wanted to thank Paul Corrigan for that, because that's, I think, another not often enough stated principle. Mark Berg got us into these ideas of bringing order from chaos, simple rules, focusing on desirable outcomes, and then considering the minimum number of essential rules that will assure getting us those outcomes, and that when one does that, one creates the incentives to develop and adopt effective processes. I thought that was a very critical notion, and I suspect it's one that when you all heard it this morning again, had some influence on your thinking. Competition. Now, there are many different kinds of competition, and the question is whether we want competitors to beat each other up and suffer various forms of brain injury, or whether we really are trying to use competitive models to make sure that everybody ultimately wins, or almost everybody wins. It's hard to be quite in nirvana. Sheila Leatherman asked earlier whether we're moving too far into thinking competition is the answer. There's really a question of what should be the basis for competition, and I would argue that we really don't want to have that many losers. We really want to have as many winners as possible. Sibel Bjorklund gave you a good reason for that today. She doesn't have a lot of choices of where she's going to move around different parts of her obstetrical care. This whole meeting is about learning from others. I found this, as all my illustrations, somewhere on the web. And it was kind of an interesting one because it was about agriculture and extension services. For those of you who have read Rogers on Diffusion of Innovations, you'll know that a lot of it came from the agricultural model that opinion leaders and change agents are based out in the agricultural extension services. And clearly, we hope that meetings like this start that process, but it's only a start, and we need to figure out how within each of our countries, we're going to extend this model out to all of the parts of our healthcare systems. A recurring theme from ministers and frankly everybody else in this meeting was the quest for value for money. And there were a number of issues raised. One had to do with the insensitivity of the public to prices, which was mentioned by Alex Czar the other night, and unconsciousness about quality and quality differences. But then John Perlin this morning asked whether or not we have the tools to do all of this. And I would wonder how, since everyone seems to be wondering whether they can get more value for money, how we're going to know when we get value for money, or when have you gotten enough value for your money, since it seems to be a never-ending quest. And at some point we'll go from constructive improvement to tampering, but that's another whole issue. And so I thought I'd finally get to the comments of Ulla Schmidt, the health minister from Germany, yesterday at the luncheon at the symposium, where she pointed out that health policy requires stamina and that she'd once been given advice that if you have a heavy load to carry, it's best to have a truck outside waiting for you. Well, we don't have trucks, but we have buses. And just again want to thank everyone for participating and really sharing your knowledge and your intellectual abilities and all of your skills with us. Thank you very much. Hope to see you next year.